But we are very, very lucky to have these three people here, and you only expected two of them, and I will introduce the third as well. Ashraf Ghani, to my immediate right, was a central figure in the creation of modern Afghanistan, and when they'll be writing the histories of Afghanistan, he would clearly be considered one of the founding fathers of the country. He was chief advisor to President Karzai during the interim administration, and he was the finance minister as the new Afghanistan developed, and in very real terms was the architect of the economic, political, and strategic contours of Afghanistan. He is now chairman of the Institute for State Effectiveness and co-author with Claire Lockhart, to his right, of a forthcoming book on fixing failed states. He spends a good part of the year still living in Kabul, where he is chancellor of the University of Kabul. Claire Lockhart, as I mentioned, with Ashraf, is co-founder and now CEO of the Institute for State Effectiveness. And even though she's only 21 or 22, she has an extraordinary career and a courageous career. After, I believe, getting the single highest score in the British Civil Service exam, which would have guaranteed her a meteoric rise in the British Foreign Service, she ended up, after being a barrister in London, working with the World Bank and assuming very challenging assignments. She was recruited onto the United Nations negotiating team for Afghanistan, and lived there from 2002 to 2005, and she has fallen in love with the country, and it's still a huge part of her life. She advised not only the government, but even recently continues to provide counseling roles in Afghanistan, recently being counselor to the head of the NATO forces in Afghanistan. And again, their book will be coming out in a number of months about especially how failed states become effective states. Hamid Wardak has already, in his young career, and also has some distinction being a top scorer academically and then choosing to go back to his native Afghanistan. He was valedictorian of his class at Georgetown, and then won a Rhodes Scholarship, and then decided, despite his opportunities for careers in the West, that he wanted to go back home, although I think he had to leave home at some point to go to school in Pakistan, as I recall. But he founded the Committee for U.S.-Afghan Partnership. He founded the Afghan-American Chamber of Commerce. He's now the CEO of a company dedicated to the reconstruction of Afghanistan. And if that is not enough, he is the founder of a democratic movement in Afghanistan, which he will talk to you about, with representation across the ethnic breadth of the country that's absolutely remarkable. He comes from a long and distinguished Afghan family. We actually hoped also to host his father here at the Ideas Festival. His father is currently the Minister of Defense in Afghanistan, but as you've probably seen from the paper, not inaccurately, it has been a challenging spring with the Taliban, and so he's not able to be here. And that kind of bravery and service for the country runs in his family. His grandfather actually died, as I understand it, defending the president, Daoud Khan, against the communists. So a long tradition of Afghan patriotism. Now, Afghanistan, I think for most of us, is a country that we barely knew about, with an exotic name and an exotic location most of us probably couldn't put on a map. And then I think it came on the world stage for many of us probably during the Taliban regime, particularly with the extraordinarily revolting to almost everyone in the world destruction of the magnificent Buddhist sculptures, and then, of course, to say nothing of the brutality of that regime. But it has had a very challenging history, to say the least. A monarchy until I think roughly 1973 or so. Then after a tremendous famine, there was a coup. The cousin of the king became a dictator, a non-communist dictator. Then from 78 to 92, the communists ruled with Russian control from about 79 to 1988. The communists collapsed in 1992. And then from 92 to 96, roughly, there was a coalition of Islamic parties and a civil war, not an unfamiliar phenomenon in that part of the world. And then, of course, in 96, the Taliban took control of Kabul and thus the government. And then after 9/11, Afghan history changed. And let's hope it's changed forever. Based on various statistics, Shashi Tharoor here from the United Nations might correct me, but I think it's probably the sixth poorest country in the world, maybe the poorest country outside of sub-Saharan Africa. Yet it's a country with absolutely extraordinary cultural richness, and one of the things that I think will come out in our conversation, particularly unlike Iraq, which we've spent a lot of time talking about the last week, despite the ethnic diversity in the country, there is an enormous sense of Afghan nationalism and pride. Regardless of what tribal area, what language is spoken, and I think we'll find from our panelists that it's one of the things that gives great hope to the prospects for Afghanistan. But obviously, Afghanistan is now, in a way, not unlike it has been at other parts of its history, much earlier history, essentially at crossroads of civilizations, you know, whether the Silk Route or the Spice Route, and the Khyber Pass, and much of Islamic and world history goes through the mountain passes of Afghanistan. And it was, you know, in I think perhaps the 11th or 12th century, one of the cities, Herat, I guess, in the west of Afghanistan, was probably the most prosperous and cultured city in the entire Islamic world, if not the entire world. And then there were some sleepy times when very little was heard. But of course, now it is of extraordinary geopolitical significance. And we are reading about it all the time. But most of what we read today is not very encouraging. And I hope our panel can tell us what the reality is today and what the prospects are. And I think you will hear from this panel, which has diverse views, but I think you will find a consensus emerging from them that despite all we see and read about Iraq, and despite we read about the incredible challenges in Afghanistan, that in fact Afghanistan may be the best hope for a democracy in that part of the world, and in a country, and many of you probably heard Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and in a country that's deeply religious, poor, and conservative. So I think we'll explore some of the ironies represented by that. But most of all, we understand, and we hope to understand from these three extraordinary people, what is going on in Afghanistan today. I thought I'd ask with a question about what are the drivers, what are the factors that are causing the incredible insecurity, if not chaos, political division, problems, Taliban in Afghanistan today? And Ashraf, maybe you can start.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to be here. Nice to see all of you. The first driver of insecurity is drugs, and it's the consumption habit of the middle class in the West that is driving it. This is not our problem alone, it is not your problem alone. We cannot eliminate this unless you eliminate your drug habit or change it.
And you're talking about opium.
Opium processed into heroin being smuggled to one of the most complex... narcotics in Afghanistan is a side effect of globalization. Without banking system in the world transferring tens of millions of dollars instantaneously, it would not function. Without the transport network, it would not function. Without global participation of criminalized networks with enormous effectiveness, it would not function. This is the central issue, because narcotics is now the dominant source of corruption and probably the key source of financing for terrorism. And all of us are participants in it. This is a global problem that cannot be solved by Afghans alone. And the key to us to get the global corporations involved in job creation issues. This is not going to be solved by pittance says on the ground. It requires a type of imagination that the Marshall Plan required. It's a global problem. That's the first driver of security, insecurity. The second driver of insecurity is terrorism. We again are at the forefront of a series of terrorist networks that have regrouped and have become stronger as the conflict in Iraq has deepened. We had about 4 years when the concentration shifted from us. First, the terrorist network was defeated, and they were very surprised by the welcome that the Afghan population accorded to international forces. United States, I don't know whether you know this or not, had the highest popularity in the world in Afghanistan, poll after poll. So this is not Iraq. There was not an act of invasion. It was not perceived by the Afghan population.
What would that be today, just a quick...
It is still high, but it's declined.
Given everything we've heard this week about how the rest of the world...
No,
still, it is...
Far higher than Turkey, your long-term ally. Far higher than Pakistan, your other long-term ally.
Certain irony there.
The population is still very much internationalist. But the terrorist activity is regrouped. It's a global network again. And we need to understand it as an effective network that is dedicated to instability. We are seeing institutionalization of forces that are dedicated to instability. Drugs, terrorism. The third driver is criminality. Outright. Criminality.
Unrelated to the opium and drug-related criminality.
Because seizure of state assets, dominating the market so it does not become a level playing field, use of violence against ordinary people. The people of Afghanistan expected from their partnership with coalition rule of law. They're getting the rule of jungle.
Yeah, an example of that might be when I was in Afghanistan in January, and everywhere I went, I was provided with five bodyguards with AK-47s. And I asked, I mean, no one knows who I am, I'm not a public figure. I said, you'd think that the danger might be a suicide bomber. And I said, suicide bomber, bodyguards aren't going to protect me, we'll all be blown up. Why do I have these people? And it was explained to me very simple. Kidnapping. And I said, well, who's going to kidnap me? And the response was, the police.
Absolutely.
I mean, is that right? I mean, that wasn't an exaggeration.
The police is the single most distrusted institution in the country. Because they invoke policing, creation of a policing force that is citizen-oriented, minimally requires 10 years. And it requires dedication and emergence of civil society. It requires a balance and total dedication to rule of law. And when you put the worst elements in the society, in the police force, they are going to become predatory. This society, the United States, saw examples of this when, during the Progressive Era, most prostitution houses were protected by the police. So it is not just new to us. A lot of places have gone where the so-called institutions that are supposed to be citizen-oriented turn against them. And that's what reduces illegitimacy. Because of this, and because of very widespread corruption, within government, there is a crisis regarding future security. And the core driver of insecurity, to sum it all, now is the breakdown of confidence and trust. Between 2001 and 2005, Afghans uniformly trusted the future. And it's not that we suddenly became wealthier or our lives improved significantly. that we had trust in the future, that the lives of our children would be better than our own lives. My generation is a generation that has lost completely everything. We lived in exile, or you know, we lost 2 million people, saw immense brutality. So we wanted rule of law, but also a pathway to mobility, predictable pathway to social mobility that could bring a change. And the type of skills that are required, you return back to an optimist. I'm still an optimist. I'm always called the pessimist optimist. I know all the difficulties, but I know we'll overcome them. So maybe I should stop and pass on to...
Yeah, so you talked about drugs, criminality, terrorism, corruption. But you haven't mentioned, you know, the interference from Iran, Pakistan. Is that a factor as well, Hamid? I mean,
absolutely. Particularly two neighboring countries, both Pakistan and from Iran. I work very closely with the tribal leaders and elders and ulama all over the country. The movement that we've been trying to build the last 2 years has been focused to be a movement.
If you could just
Sorry.
A little.
Is that better? The movement that we've been trying to build the last 2 years has been a movement from the grassroots level. So the information I get isn't necessarily from the government. It's from the elders, the tribal leaders, and the shuras. And this government, when I was came about in the name of these elders and these ulama, when you speak to them, particularly in the areas that border Pakistan, there's a lot of strong evidence pointing towards the fact that there's a lot of Pakistani involvement, particularly with aiding and abetting the terrorists back and forth. Similarly, I was telling Elliot today, I disagree with a statement that my own father made a couple of weeks ago about Iranian involvement in Afghanistan. With the others that I've spoken to, and the Taliban that they've seen, they're carrying around Iranian weapons with Iranian markings. And the Taliban that we've even captured in some of our other types of activities, they have told us that when they get injured, they get taken to Iran. They get taken to Tehran. So you notice a lot more involvement, particularly on the Iranian side, which seems to be a new thing the last couple of months or 6 months. I'm not sure when it started, but now the others talk about that. What I also wanted to add to the problems that Minister Ghani reflected on very, very wisely is that two other things that I see in Afghanistan that's a tremendous problem is there's a huge disconnect between the population and the political elites. You see, elites who are completely in their palatial homes are not in any way connected to the local problems that people have. When there's a court case in a district or a province, it isn't justice or the rule of law that decides that issue. It comes down to connection, to who you know. And that is how justice is rendered. And so what happens is that local population begins to lose hope in the process. And with time, what you've seen is people become not against the government right now. They're neutral on the fence. And the discussions, but they're very wise. Afghans might not be the most educated people, but they have PhDs in politics. We deal with them, practical politics. So they are very keen on dividing the problems. They don't blame the West. They don't see the West as an occupation force. They look at their own government and they say, with all this support, with all those resources, how come we still have this system in place? It must be these elites because they keep on benefiting from the process and there's no way of connecting the process. Number two, when the elders do get to meet the elites and when the leaders in our government promise them to remove a bad governor, a bad police chief, and when it doesn't happen, when this continues, it builds a lack of hope and trust, which is very important that Minister Ghani pointed out. Number two, from sort of my perspective and from the leaders of our group, we believe that too much has been imposed on us at once. Not only do we have to build a democratic state, we have to build institutions from scratch. And then we have to fight a war against drugs. And we have to fight a war against terror. This is so much to ask for, and to start immediately at all this at once, we believe is quite demanding on a country.
Why don't you tell us about the support for the Taliban? I mean, how should we understand that support? How broad is it geographically? How deep is it? Is it out of religious devotion? What are the real dimensions
of Taliban popular support in Afghanistan?
Well, myself, I believe, after dealing with the elders for 2 years now, particularly in the south and the east, this is where the Taliban's activities are focused, there's no reason to negotiate with them because they're politically bankrupt with the population, ideologically bankrupt with the population. What you do have is a lot of propaganda from the Pakistani side. You have brainwashed orphan or even drug addicts who are taught that they can go to heaven or they're bribed. But at the same time, rightfully, there are minorities out there who have been impacted by coalition activities. For example, bat searches at night. In our culture, you don't walk into a man's house and search their wife, particularly. And I've heard stories where people have been naked. Coalition troops have come in and have asked the man, the husband and the wife, to come out completely naked. So that turns certain people against the process. But that's really a minority group. Casualties, which is an unfortunate part of a war. Some of those casualties have turned people against the war, but this is really, really minor. It hasn't turned people against the West. The Taliban tried to use this to their benefit, but it isn't really working out. The allies that you do see with the Taliban at this point is really related to what Minister Ghani said, the drug traffickers in particular. A deal being made between the Taliban and the drug traffickers and the farmers in terms of protecting their crops. So it really is not ideological, it's financial. And so you see these very temporary agreements and financial arrangements between the Taliban. And lastly, of course, it's fear. The population, if it doesn't cooperate, it isn't because it's supportive of the Taliban movement, it's because the government isn't strong enough, or the government's predatory, or the government can't act to protect it, so they remain neutral. But you don't have very much, too much, in my opinion, active Taliban support in the country.
Well, before we get more depressed than we thought we were from watching the news, let's try to understand, instead of the drivers of the current insecurity, why are in various ways, and I think to some degree in consensus, the three of you in fact optimistic? And maybe Claire, we could start with you. You are now a student and writing and trying to do worldwide work to create effective states. Why is it in your adopted Afghanistan, despite these incredible problems, why is it that you feel that there are the soil for a functioning, effective democracy?
Well, thank you for having me here. I think two things. One is institution building really is possible, and we see examples of it across the world. It doesn't take 300 years to build a functioning institution. And we see that in examples from the American South transforming in just a few years. We see that in Singapore, Malaysia, Chile. A number of countries around the world have made really rapid transformations. Accession countries in Eastern Europe really is possible. In Afghanistan particularly, I think there's huge reason to have great hope. And the first of these really is the desire of the Afghan population. In my experience, unanimously, a desire for partnership with the international community, wanting to be integrated into the process of globalization. And after 23 years of war, exhausted from fighting and looking forward to a peaceful era, as Ashraf said, where people's children and grandchildren can grow up to a different life. One of my first visits in Afghanistan was to the north in Mazar, and I met a woman and she said, "I may be nearly blind and I'm illiterate, but I'm not stupid." She said, "I've heard that Mr. Karzai got $4 billion at the Tokyo conference." She said, "I don't want him to squander it quickly in all these little projects." She said, "I want him to put it in a trust fund. And I want him to spend it over 20 years to build an accountable civil service so that my children and grandchildren can have a better life." And so a real sense from the population of what it takes to build institutions that do function. A couple more examples. I think in the period after 2001, nobody imagined after September 11 that we would have a successful peace agreement at the Bonn Agreement, that there would be the inauguration of a new regime under Chairman Karzai, that we would be able to hold an emergency Lloyd Jirga, a meeting of people from across the country, and lead to elections. Across the world, from Chancellor Schroeder to Tony Blair, I think people were very pessimistic that any of this would be possible. And yet this process went pretty much without a hitch. couple more examples. People have told me it's impossible to create a business in Afghanistan. Yet, within a few months after the inauguration of the new regime at the end of 2001, there was a transparent tender scheme for a new GSM mobile scheme. The Aga Khan bid for one of the licenses and won. And a few weeks later, up some rickety steps in a muddy old building, a few short months later, you walked... Okay. A few short months later, in the top of the old post office building, you walked through a door, and you could have been in New York. You created a gleaming modern switch with young Afghans in suits newly trained, operating high modern technology. The Afghan National Army is another example. A new institution was created from scratch that's now one of the bulwarks of security and stability in the country. Another scheme was a process by which the government gave block grants of $20,000 to pretty much every village in the country, distributed through domestic networks. So, and we could go on. Number of cases where within months or years it's possible to create functioning organizations.
Ashraf, what are some of the other assets that give you optimism?
The first one is the ordinary Afghan.
The ordinary
Afghan, woman or man. 86% of the women, 92% of the men listen to 3 radio stations a day. And 60% of that news is international. You go to an Afghan village, anywhere, and ask 2 questions. How many of you have been abroad? Nearly 90% of the hands go up. Then you ask, how many of you have relatives abroad? And another 80% goes. And it's a really networked society. Remittances, education, career paths. It's a true sign. You know, I mean, our poverty should not hide our social wealth, which is these connections. The demand for rule of law from an ordinary Afghan has never been higher. When there is order, unlike Iraq, our people seek order. A reliable order that is predictable and that can deliver to them. An example is the election. In the presidential election, 8 million people stood for nearly 12 hours. 80-year-old women came out that had never been outside their homes to vote because they thought it mattered. And the lines were as orderly as you could be. You know, we stand in line. We're very egalitarian people. We've never had caste, and caste is new to us. Now, thanks to, you know, the contracting industries, we might get an elite that is not accountable or to drugs. But before that, there's a sense of equality that is fundamental to a democratic society. No Afghan will concede superiority to another Afghan. Leadership is not inherited. It's won. And it's won through accomplishment. But also, as Amdwadak was saying very earlier, our people have a very good sense of judgment. The collective sense of judgment is profound, and it seeks rule of law. It seeks justice, and now it seeks a level playing field. So this is the first asset. The second one is international. The commitment of both forces and resources are very real. You're putting your children. There is no greater gift than these young men and women, and there are 35,000 of them in Afghanistan. Who could have imagined that 35,000 young women and men from nearly 60 countries will be in Afghanistan putting their lives on the line? NATO's future is going to be determined in Afghanistan. This is a very, very significant commitment. Second is the nature of resources. In the 6th year of a conflict, Afghanistan is the rare country that is getting a second renewal in wind of attention. Third is...
Let me just ask on that one, though. Is there a risk because of the frustration about the experience in Iraq that people will give up? You say that even though 6 years after, there are still international troops, international efforts. Is there a risk that the international dismay about Iraq, talk about withdrawing,
saying it's impossible will spill over to Afghanistan?
Until now, no. There's been a very clear difference internationally, and I think among the American political establishment and thus far generally, that Afghanistan, first intervention in Afghanistan was a case of justice. There was no external desire to go to Afghanistan. There were no war plans for Afghanistan. Everything had to be improvised. When Secretary Powell came to the UN, when both Claire and I were advising and serving on the UN team, you know what he said? Shashi will probably remember it. Speed, speed, speed. And a year later he came and said, I have one word for you. Well done, well done, well done. But a multilateralist agreement was struck. Afghanistan is an indication of international legitimacy at its best. I had to drag the UN to this. They were really screaming when I proposed that the UN get involved, and they said, no, it's too risky. They have been burned in too many places.
And it does seem that Democrat, Republican alike...
It's a bipartisan support.
No one is talking about leaving Afghanistan. But get back. You're talking about the resources that Afghanistan has.
Afghanistan is not poor. In terms of mineral wealth, it's one of the richest countries on earth. You know, a copper mine right now is under tender, and the bids are between $1 billion and $2 billion. And that's the beginning of a process. If tendering of the mineral wealth of the country is done transparently, like telecom, you know, we got $800 million in private sector investment for telecom. With 100 mobile phones, we now have 2.5 million mobile phones. Another 2 years, we're going to have 5 million mobile phones. 70% of the country is already covered. Then is the location. You know, our location, which turned us into one of the worst neighborhoods on earth, again, is the key. South Asia and Central Asia have to connect. And they have no other way of connecting but through a prosperous and stable Afghanistan. And lastly, we're in the middle of three key booming areas of the world. The Gulf, with $240 billion of surplus money right now, looking for investment. India, our historic trade partner. In China, our neighbor. I mean, one has to be a genius to get it wrong.
Yeah, but what about the...
And we are capable, of course, of it.
But what about that very, very location? I mean, how does Pakistan view the prospect of having an India... a prosperous and democratic and stable India on one side and a prosperous and stable and democratic Afghanistan?
Well, this is the $100 million or $100 billion question. Pakistan is deeply insecure vis-a-vis its relation with the West. This army has invested in 53 years of partnership with the West, and it feels like a stepchild. And the Pakistan-Afghanistan relationship cannot be a zero-sum game. Afghans have always been realistic. The West is irreducible interests in Pakistan. We understand that. Everybody does. A nuclear power cannot allow it to collapse or to become even more unstable than it is. But the world also is irreducible interests in Afghanistan because terrorism in unstable Afghanistan. My first case is very simple. You are not in Afghanistan because of charity or because you like us. If you did, you would have come in 92, when we were dying massively and after we had ousted the Soviet Union. We were allowed to be terrorized and terrorized by a group of thugs, and nobody cared. We couldn't get an appointment with an assistant secretary. It is because of stability. Afghanistan is central now towards stability. Because of that, there's a real project of partnership.
Let me ask you this question about why would anyone go there? Here we have two young, incredibly talented people. Hamid has dual U.S.-Afghan citizenship, and Claire isn't even Afghan. And you have chosen to devote a substantial part of your lives, and Hamid all of your life now, to a country with these circumstances. I mean, Hamid, why did you go back? And obviously you believe that there is an incredible future for your country. I mean, is this just out of blind patriotism, or do you really believe that this country can succeed?
I cannot say that I do not love my country. And what you find with Afghans is that we're very nationalistic, and we're survival-oriented people. So firstly, of course, it's because of love of the country. But when you get there, you realize that this is, I don't feel depressed when I'm in Afghanistan. When I'm there, I feel we can win this war. It just needs to, it needs the right leadership. It needs coordination of effort on all sides. And that gives you a sense of hope. When you talk to the leaders, you talk to the elders, you meet a lot of good people. You know, I never knew someone like Minister Rouhani existed before this process even started. You know, I'm very proud to know someone like Minister Rouhani has been a candidate for the World Bank presidency, for the Secretary Generalship. You know, we have a lot of very talented people. They're just not being utilized properly. But the fact that we have these human assets, we have a strong desire from our population, that we have such interest from the international community, yes, you know, I feel very, you know.
I want to come back to that, but I also want to hear you, Claire. What is it about Afghanistan that...
Well, first of all, it's just the rules of international civil service. Firstly, the rules of international civil service after September 11. A number of us from the World Bank and UN were told we were going. And those were the rules.
But you stayed.
I stayed. I think a couple of reasons, as both Ashraf and Hamid have said, the Afghan people had first trust in the process. And I think that's one of the things we're seeing today, that when I went around the country recently and met with groups, they said, we trusted you. I hope not me personally, but we trusted you, the UN, NATO, to deliver us a legitimate government. And we believed in that, and we still want to believe in that. So a real sense of what was created, which was a partnership between the Afghan people and the multilateral institutions. And I think personally, it was a belief that really it can be done. It really is possible to create, in the right amount of time, a prosperous and secure Afghanistan.
Is there something different about Afghanistan? When I had the privilege of visiting Hamid and meeting the representatives of his political movement, and you know, if there were an American TV camera surveying the room, people would think that I was in a Taliban meeting. I mean, apparently deeply religious people wearing traditional dress, speaking different tribal...
There were women also.
But I was going to ask you that point. But they're still very traditional, very religious, and yet, despite what we often hear, a sense, and I sensed it in this room, and you obviously believe it, that there can in fact be a functioning democracy in this deeply religious, deeply traditional country.
Absolutely. Hello? Absolutely. And when you dealing with the elders of Afghanistan from all over the country, you realize that there are a lot of misperceptions. Even I had misperceptions. I had grown up under the Afghan conflict, lived in Pakistan, while my father fought against the Soviets. And I read a lot about Afghanistan while I was in school. And when I came back, I had certain perceptions. But these perceptions conflicted with the reality when you met the elders. You expected a tribal religious leader not to want to sit down and talk in front of another woman, particularly when it was a member of parliament. But you didn't see that. You saw people actually respecting the time and giving each other 5 minutes. They made a rule between themselves that each would have 5 minutes to talk, particularly if we had foreigners come to the meetings and listen to their grievances. So you saw this respect. But something else that we saw when I was dealing with the different elders from different ethnic communities, the beginning, because people are segregated into different regions, there's a lot of ethnicism when it comes to grievances also at times. They'll say, you know, it's that tribe that's making, or that ethnic group that is actually getting all the resources in the government. The Pashtuns will blame the Tajiks will blame the Pashtuns, the Uzbeks didn't know who to blame, the Hazaras were completely clueless to who was really in power. But when they started dealing with each other, when I brought people from the different provinces and I flew them in on the occasion that you were there, what they realize is that they all have the same problems, and the other side isn't actually wealthy. That it's a very small elite, a very bad elite in the country that's not ethnic oriented.
You spoke earlier about the degree of support that there is for the Taliban. You said it's not really, really very great.
Yes.
If there were a free and fair election in Afghanistan today, would President Karzai be reelected?
No comment.
Let's open up questions to the audience. Yes.
Actually, that was part of my question. I'm glad to hear all the good things about Afghanistan, because we really don't hear that much. But one thing that I read, and I don't read it in our regular press, but in I hear BBC and NPR, is that President Karzai cannot leave Kabul, that it's too dangerous for him to go to the rest of his country, that he's sort of like a prisoner in the city there. And also, Hamid, you glossed over this, quote, collateral damage that happens when we bomb, when NATO and the Americans bomb, the Taliban. And you said it's a very small outrage, and I hear differently. I hear it's a major outrage, and that all this is getting back to the president from the people in the countryside, because they are being killed. Innocent people are being killed. So, I'm glad good things are happening, but I think you're glossing over some of the really important issues there.
Sure. When I said that, in reference to the bombings and the casualties, people are not happy when that happens, but a very few proportion of them start fighting them coalition troops after that. They ask for grievances to be met, for there to be compensation for their debts. And my little experience so far in Afghanistan dealing with the media has been they like to sensationalize stories. They want to find bad news, and so to sensationalize it, not to put it down completely. Secondly, on the president's part, in terms of being surrounded because of security, that's true for all of us in Afghanistan. It's dangerous for all of us in the country to move around, regardless of the parts of the leadership. But if you want to bring a stable Afghanistan, you must be connected to the people and to their grievances.
Other questions?
There's one here. Oh,
here.
The sense that we get from the press, and I listen to NPR as well as various other media sources, but the sense that we've gotten certainly in the last year or two are that things are rapidly deteriorating and that things are going very badly, and that there's huge dissatisfaction with the NATO forces, and that there's not nearly the sense of hope that we're hearing from all of you. What do you attribute to the disconnect between what we hear from the media and what you're reporting is really going on?
Ashraf?
Yeah. Two issues. First, when we're talking optimistically, we're talking about the medium to long term. Today, there's a crisis of confidence. When we began with drivers of insecurity, I hope it is very clear when the police is the source of predation, that's a collective failure. When corruption rules the courts and jobs are for sale and nothing is done about that, each of that causes alienation. In terms of use of force, the Afghan population is on the tipping point. If use of force continues without radical improvement in their livelihoods, they will change their mind. We have to be very clear about this. Forces are in place, resources are in place, but there's a total strategic vacuum. There is no strategy driving the process forward. The reason we're seeing disenchantment is because there's a disconnect between the hopes and aspirations that we put forward to the bond process and the deterioration in quality of governance. This is the most significant driver. Hope can be nurtured even when you take baby steps, but you're going the right direction. There was loss of momentum. Since end of 2005, there's been a distinctive loss of momentum. What we are saying simultaneously is that this loss of momentum is not irreversible. That with the right understanding and right type of commitment, it can be reversed. That our optimism should not be confused with lack of understanding of the current reality. The current reality calls for urgent, coordinated measures with a goal that can get the population again to trust the process. My last observation, force will never be sufficient to bring stability in Afghanistan. Force will never be sufficient to bring stability. We are not that kind of people.
We don't obey force. The Soviets tried with 110,000 of their most brutal soldiers. What legitimacy does, force cannot do. The coalition came because it had legitimacy. So we need to understand the use of force very clearly. It is necessary. NATO won a very decisive victory in southern Afghanistan last year, and it's not been widely appreciated. But use of force is only one component. What is the most common definition of a Talib in southern Afghanistan? An unemployed youth. It's unemployment that is a critical driver of security. 60% of our population is under 20. The next presidential election is going to be determined by people who don't have a clue to what the Soviet invasion was or what the Civil War was about. They are going to make their judgments based on what the government and the international community does for them. Namely, does it give them a future of upward mobility? But again, for optimism. You know, I talked to all the 9,000 students of Kabul University over a three-month process of consultation. The students of an Islamic law, you know what they wanted on top of their priorities? Obligatory classes in English and computer sciences.
Shashi has a question.
I just want to follow up on this. I mean, the loss of momentum, some would say, probably began in 2002 when the U.S. began to be distracted by the imminent invasion of Iraq, and the many were concerned that the diversion of resources at that time turned what looked like an imminent victory into the kind of mess we've seen over the years. Do you share that view? And linked to that, I mean, you made the observation, Ashraf, in your comment here, that sort of the international interest and momentum and so on is back now. Is it sufficient? Does it require more? I mean, given where you were, where the international community was in 2002, with the Taliban completely defeated and in disarray, and where we are now, where they have regrouped and have had financing from abroad and have clearly been able to kill a lot of NATO soldiers, so this is not entirely media exaggerations. Is the amount of both military and developmental resources being committed adequate? Because there's always the feeling that if in 2002 the US had been there, the sort of commitment and the resources it was seeming to be bringing in, and built highways and universities and found employment possibilities for people, that we might not even be where we are today.
The question for those of you in the back was essentially, might victory have been imminent in 2002 were it not for the distraction of Iraq, and are there sufficient resources continuing today to develop as you hope?
The following points. First, resources are only one factor. For instance, if we give $10 billion to the UN agencies, you will still get any legitimacy in Afghanistan. Because they're corrupt and not accountable. With $1 billion that distributed through channels that they really see effects and have the decision rights over them, people will have a different outcome. So on the first issue, whether Iraq irreversibly caused the slowdown and loss of momentum in Afghanistan, no. The main reason is the election. The presidential election and the constitution making could have not taken place unless there was a clear commitment to momentum. And second, the nature of reforms that were carried between 2002 and 2004. None of our neighbors in the last 20 years is carried as many reforms as we did in 2 years. So it was an expectation. The people expected the election to be the beginning of a process of cleaning up the government and making it really accountable. When corruption really set in, that became a disabling factor. On the second one, of resources, what would have taken $10 million in 2002 is now going to take $200 million. Because to regain the trust of the ordinary Afghan is going to require not just a lot more investment, it is going to require radically different modalities of business. One example. Claire will tell you the story, but I'll steal it from her for a minute. She went to Central Afghanistan. They were being given beams to build their
They have groups. But before we put this program of national solidarity, where people made the decisions, NGOs made the decisions. They go with the wrong beams. So what did the people do? They sold it on the market, so then they could buy the right beams. What was the transaction cost? Almost 40%. $1 of American money, you know how much is it worth on the ground in Afghanistan? Between 10 and 20 cents. 80 to 90 cents of it comes back to the United States because laws are structured that there is a cascade of contracting. And so the real value of money, it's not the nature of resources alone, it is how we use these. But the last point is winning use of our fund resources, because Afghanistan is not going to be stabilized through foreign aid. We have to have a strategy of investment in growth. And that is where investment in people and in institutions is going to be most significant. I'll close with one example. About $800 billion at least, if not a billion, is gone to technical assistance. I cannot get $100 million for Kabul University. What is the difference when an institution can produce 4,000 graduates a year to staff, men and women, and Afghan women have fantastic managerial skills. I appointed a woman under 30 as the director of treasury. She created a single treasury account within 1 year. It's a record in history. Indonesia still has 60,000 accounts. But you have to invest in gender relations. And there's all talk of gender, but gender equality is not going to be established through patterns of microcredit. Invest in the young women to become leaders. My class that went to Beirut in 1968 is produced the current U.S. ambassador to the UN, president of the California Bay Area, vice president of MCI, and dean of Carleton University in California. Why can't we approach the Afghan youth of today with the same opportunities that my class was given? Then things will be different.
Okay. That's gentleman in the second row. Yes. Yes.
Hi. I recently read the book Three Cups of Tea about Greg Mortensen's efforts to build schools in Afghanistan, with particular emphasis on schools for girls to get them at least through the fifth grade in the remote mountain camps. And I had the opportunity to meet him recently briefly in Breckenridge. I'd like to hear from your perspective.
Let my colleagues come in.
About the success of that effort. And
questions about efforts to build schools, and particularly for girls in rural Afghanistan. Claire?
I'm afraid I don't know the initiative.
You have to speak.
I haven't had the pleasure of finding out about that particular initiative, and I'd love to find out more about it. I don't know if my colleagues have done. I think there's enormous amount, and it's testament to, again, this partnership between the international community and the Afghans, that there have been so much volunteerism over the last few years.
May I just make a comment on that? Because we've had such fantastic discussions on technology. I think our approach to education in Afghanistan is fundamentally wrong.
It's wrong.
Why are we building schools in the remotest parts of the country where we should be providing education through television and through radio?
So doing remote education.
Remote education is, we don't have the teachers. The teachers are among the most corrupt. They are not trained. These schools are fantastic, and there are exceptions, and I welcome the initiative very much. But investing in human capital requires thinking through the modern age. 70% of the country has mobile coverage now. We need to be able to think of technology in very different ways to reach and invest in them.
Is there a question over here?
I've understood Afghanistan is the most heavily mined area in the world, that as many as 10% of Afghan men have lost the leg.
Yeah.
To mining. Is NATO or the international community doing anything to remove these mines? Two, are NATO troops using mines? And three, the United States using cluster bombs?
Questions are about mines.
You should have this discussion at your home every day.
NATO forces, from what I know, are not laying mines. And in terms of cluster bombs,
I have not heard cluster bombs being used. Now, in terms of the country being mined and whether they're demining efforts, absolutely, there are demining efforts in the country. Particularly when you see the contracts that are awarded on the construction in the country, it all has a demining component in it.
So, gentleman in the front row.
I'd like you to help me understand a little bit better about the opiate problem. It strikes me that about the only thing that the Taliban seems to have done right was to crush opium production in Afghanistan. It seems to have come back with a vengeance since they've gone. Why has it come back so rapidly, and why is it that whatever the Taliban did can't be done?
The question in the back is more about opium and noting this apparent success of the Taliban to reduce substantially opium production, but now it's increasing rapidly.
First, the seeming success of the Taliban. It happened only 1 year. And when post-September 11, it became clear that military operations were going to take place, what happened to passive heroin? It dropped down by a factor of 4 in Europe within 6 weeks. What did that indicate? There were enormous stashes in place, so that 1 year effort could really be used in similar to the diamonds being controlled. There's a natural fact. Opium keeps almost indefinitely. It has a very, very long shelf life. And a lot of opium was stored in those years because the previous years have been such bumper crops. Heroin is unstable, so the minute it's processed, it has to move. Second, collective failure. The international community, the first thing I told the international community was that one of the three scenarios for the future of Afghanistan was that it could become a narco-mafia state. This, the international community was told in December of 2001. So from the Afghan side, the warning was very clear. We did not receive the partnership. We were opened up to the mafia, massively, to the global mafia. 1% of Afghanistan, 1% of the agricultural territory of Afghanistan produces all the 90% of the heroin of the world. And there's no ecological limit. The wonder really is why it is not, and it's market forces that are the answer. Second, the coalition decided to make a partnership with elements that had denounced it. Their very actions had brought the Taliban. And the coalition put those people in power and disregarded their trafficking or allegations regarding their trafficking very deliberately. Third, international forces that have been deployed have not taken narcotics as their central challenge.
Please.
Add on that, I think we've heard that the aid system isn't really a system at all, and it's approaching many of the agencies and NGOs do extremely valuable work, but their mental model is one of, well, let's just get Afghanistan from really poor to slightly less poor. Let's just get people from 50 cents a day income to $1 a day income, and that'll be enough. And if one wants to provide real alternative livelihoods for the population so that they do switch into other economies, then we've got to approach the problem on a completely different scale of thinking. It was actually a meeting here a couple of years ago at Aspen, and a group of CEOs got together and thought through this problem. And they were putting together proposals. They said, what it's going to take to really crack this problem from the economic perspective is a $10 billion fund that's going to create partnerships with American consumers, global corporations, and really think the value chains backwards to what Afghan citizens can be involved with in the global economy. And that partnership and that collaboration is not yet in place.
Let me just follow up with a question, and then we'll ask one more, and then we're going to have to maybe ask for some concluding remarks, and then perhaps, I know Hamid has another engagement. You can stay and have a further conversation if we can keep the room for a little while. But why is it that there can't be something done with all of the opium production that could, in fact, be used legitimately for medical uses in much of the world that has no access to painkillers? Why does it have to be only this criminal opportunity the farmers have?
You should ask that question.
Oh, thank you. First, in some parts of Afghanistan, we are going to ultimately come to this very solution. But second, there is enormous resistance from our partners. If it were an Afghan alone operation, we would have arrived at this very quickly. But there are major stakeholders in drug eradication with very narrow foresight. Plan Colombia is being repeated in Afghanistan. And there is an entire set of interests that benefit from that approach. So you have to break the nature of the mental models in key developed countries regarding what it takes. The approaches are traditional, as Claire was saying. Where I would begin would first be for market access. The greatest things the United States could do for us in terms of eradication of opium is to give us a textile quota. A textile quota for 20 years. Because cotton will not compete with opium. A t-shirt will. So you have to create the value chain. Second is jobs for women. Women in Afghanistan are not involved in production of opium. But the household looks at its total income. And if women really have reliable jobs, for instance, jewelry, can create 1 to 1.5 million jobs. And these are clean jobs, you know, they have to be regulated with due conditions. It's those type of approaches. It's Afghan women, for instance, are among the best in terms of embroidery in the world. But their products are sold in hospital auctions in Kabul. We've been asking for 7 years now for partnership with key chains, fashion houses in Italy, and supermarket chains. If you want to change the value proposition from opium to incorporation of the world economy, then you have to think through these relationships. Opium is a very large part of a very small economy. The key lies in expanding that economy. Countries with legitimate income per capita of $1,000 don't produce opium. It's backbreaking work. And that is where I think we need to really partner in new ways to be able to handle this problem. But we have to overcome the obstacle. Afghanistan is at the frontier of figuring out new ways of governance. In terms, because the international community is going to be engaged in Afghanistan 10 to 15 years. And we have to think through our entire ways and approaches to see how we evolve a partnership that we change a situation from instability to one of stability. And the core of stability is going to lie in making Afghan population stakeholders in a process of upward social mobility.
Hamid has a comment.
I just wanted to add two things to Mr. Ghani's statements. Number one, if we're going to combat the narcotics trade on the legal side and the police side, we have to remove a lot of people who actually are part of the counter-narcotics effort, but they themselves are the drug traffickers in the Ministry of Interior and the counter-narcotics departments. So you need to remove them on that side of the equation. Number two, from my experience so far, something that Minister Ghani said, I'm working on a counter-narcotics project, and you see this, is that the government contractors spend probably 20 cents out of the dollar in Afghanistan. And so how are you going to combat the drug trafficking trade when such a minor amount makes it to the country? And you also see a lot of different approaches to alternative livelihoods are not coordinated. The different agencies don't coordinate with each other, from the State Department to the other donor communities. So you need more coordination, because this is a very difficult project. And number three, something that Minister Ghani said before too, I think, you know, by force spraying, aerial spraying or anything like that, and not taking the Afghans into account and using a step-by-step process is just going to turn the population more against the process.
Gentleman in the green has been very patient.
I come away somewhat pessimistic from this conversation because forgetting the Taliban, which, I mean, you can't forget, but here's a country with so much culture and so much to give, but yet I hear about corruption. I hear that you need five guards and everybody else agrees. What solutions do you have to having a strong central government, whether it's a democracy or some other form, that is going to be effective?
I think that's a wonderful closing question, really, because we've heard, contrary again to what many of the things we've heard this week, that the traditional, religious, poor, rural, all of these problems, there still is the opportunity for a functioning democracy. But we've also heard a thread through all of this that the government is ineffective. The government is grossly ineffective. So what is the solution to that, and what can be done practically, and how long will it take? And maybe each could comment before we close.
Okay, I'll start first. For myself, the focus for me is the government itself. It needs change of leadership. You realize many leaders in this government are involved in the very, they are the problem makers for society. So you need a change of leadership. You need to bring back people like Minister Ghani into the government. You know, the one thing, you know, that hasn't been said, and I will say, like, Minister Ghani was a very important driving force for reform. With his departure, many, he was the political and economic visionary for our country at that point. With his departure, and people below him, like him, who he's been grooming, been working with, you know, we've lost a strong reform segment in our society, in the political process. Someone who listened to Afghans and someone who was connected with the international community. So for me, what's very important is an organized, reformed movement and leadership that takes over the government and begins the reforms that we had all believed were supposed to be in process.
Claire.
I think I agree that it's a problem with many dimensions, as we've heard. I still have a lot of hope, and I believe it can be done. I think the first thing is to change our expectations of timelines. The international community rushed in and promised to create Germany within a year, and that wasn't realistic. Institution building doesn't need to take 300 years, but it's not going to be done overnight. And having a more realistic sense that it does take 10 to 15 years, institutions by their very definition are repeated over time, it's going to take 10 to 15 years, and we have to start planning for on those kind of timelines. I think where I'd come back to, and my faith is in the Afghan population. And one thing we've seen over the last years is looking at the way that communities manage the social capital that exists in the villages across the country. And a program I mentioned before, National Solidarity Program, where villages have elected by secret ballot their own village councils. They agree to meet, 70% of the village comes together to meet to decide on their own projects, and then they put up in a public place their accounts. So you have democracy, participation, and accountability at the village level. And as I understand it, this autumn, 40,000 village leaders are going to come to Kabul for the National Convention of Communities. And that, to me, is really, like in your country, a real testament to local democracy. It really is possible in the country. So at the village level, I don't think one needs to have any concern. It's getting the configuration right at the district, at the province, at the centre, and amongst the international community. What we've seen is this huge coordination problem. Getting this collaborative governance structure right, it is going to be a huge challenge, but that again should be able to be sorted out.
Thank you. The first thing I'll do is I'll put $1 billion in higher education and technical education. And I would put a target of 50% women, 50% men. That is the future of the country. The country is ready to have gender equality. And if after gender apartheid, we cannot invest in gender equality, it's going to take us another 100 years. This group, if we invest in this group, they will be able to staff the government. Let's be very direct. There's a tiny elite that does not want an educated population to run the country democratically, because political power has become key to economic gain. Abuse of political office for massive gaining of personal fortunes has become the norm. Second thing is naming and shaming. Let the US stop meeting with drug dealers. Let's name them. There are 25 individuals, according to a World Bank study, that are controlling the entire drug network. Why is the international community failing to name them? No, we have to come to terms. Either we have priorities or we pay lip service. If elimination of drugs is a national and international priority, then let's not pretend that the same people are essential for other purposes. The drug network has to be smashed. If it is not smashed, we are not going to have stability. Thirdly, the international community has to get its act together. It has to overcome its inherited bureaucratic inertia. It has to acquire nimbleness and capability to be able to fight an all-sided war that it has not fought before. We need to define the problem and then have some set of priorities. Without trust with the Afghan counterparts and attention at the highest level of G8, this process is not going to move as rapidly as we want it. Because it is a new challenge which is multidimensional, and it requires an approach that has not been tried before. But then internet was just a glance in somebody's mind. So I think with sufficient imagination and resourcefulness, we can turn the situation around, but it should not be forgotten that it's a formidable problem. I mean, you mentioned the question of mines. The amount of ammunition that is present today in Afghanistan is still one of the highest in the world, and a lot of it is unstable. The Soviet Union and the West combined at least dumped $10 billion worth of armament to our country. The legacy, you know, I had to evacuate 80 tons of scrap metal from Kabul University. The shells of tanks were in front of our kindergartens. The devastation, you know, we lost between 1978 and 2001 $240 billion in damaged infrastructure or in lost opportunity. So the amount of assistance compared to that loss has really been very, very small. That goes back to Shashi. But the package is not money alone. It is a wider set of alliances, and you really are the core of them. The most significant thing is that the decent people in the world do not forget us. That is the core foundation, because it's relation between people and people that is going to be the ultimate source of success and stability in Afghanistan.
Well, I don't think any of this group will certainly forget, and I don't think the world will, and we thank you all very, very, very much.